Mood swings, impulsiveness, sometimes bizarre behavior. What's the power and purpose of the teenage brain? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is neuropsychiatrist and best-selling author Dr. Daniel Siegel. Brainstorm is his latest book. In it, he explores how brain development affects teenage behavior and relationships. He explains how we navigate the adolescent years and how that navigation has a direct impact on how we'll live the rest of our lives. Siegel is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine. Why teens do what they do after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Remember what it was like being a teenager? Many of us think back on our own teenage years and wonder, was I really like that? Did I really do that? Did I really say that to my mom or my dad? Well, and then as parents, we have to endure that sort of behavior from our own kids when they become teens. Mood swings, impulsiveness, sometimes bizarre behavior. It's just something we parents have to weather until our children are mature enough to see the world the way we do, as sensible adults. Well, that's the common view anyway. This hour, it's all about getting a different view of adolescence. In fact, it's an hour during which we'll not only bust myths about teen years, but also find out how we adults can enrich our own lives and how we can perhaps bust out of a life full of routine and make our own lives more vital by learning from the teenage brain. My guest is neuropsychiatrist and best-selling author Dr. Daniel Siegel, author of Parenting from the Inside Out and The Whole Brain Child. His latest book is titled Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Dr. Siegel, welcome to our program.
Ben, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We wanted to mention, too, that you are a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, co-director of the UCLA Mindful Awareness Research Center and executive director of the MindSight Institute. MindSight, that's something we want to talk about a little bit later in the program. But let's start off with the gist of your book. Lots of parenting books about teenage behavior, how to handle it, how to approach it. How is your approach different? What do you want to say here?
Well, the first thing that's different is this is a book that's written for an adolescent and an adult to both read. And there's nothing out there that I could find when my own kids were going through the teenage years and now that they're in their 20s for them to really understand what was going on inside of them in a deep way and for me to share with them as I read the same thing. So that's the first thing. It's an invitation for an exploration together of the adolescent period. The second thing is, just as you said in the introduction, you know, this is an opportunity to take what happened in the last 12 years, which is an explosion in the science of the adolescent brain that has revealed things we just had no idea about. In many ways, these are eye-popping ideas that change the way we can parent and change the ways we can even approach ourselves as adolescents. So I wanted to translate the science, and as I was doing that, what I realized in the writing was that there are common myths that we all hear about, whether we're teenagers or older adolescents, or whether we're adults, that are actually not only wrong, they're misleading, and in some ways, they're disempowering. So by learning the truths, you actually can understand things as they actually are and then do something about them. So instead of being disempowered, you're actually empowered. Mm-hmm. And the final thing, as you mentioned too, is that this was really mind-blowing to me, but when I went through what the essence of adolescence was from the studies of the changes in the brain of the adolescent, it turns out that those key features are exactly what other scientific studies of the adult brain show are the ways to actually keep your brain young throughout the lifespan. So then it became something that was an invitation also for adults to take on and enrich their lives.
Okay, let's explore that. We'll get to the myths in a little bit, but first let's talk about the changes. And first and foremost, what strikes me, and I'm assuming a lot of readers of this book, is the age range that you consider goes far beyond what we normally consider as adolescence, starting at 12 up to 24 years of age. Why?
That's right. So that's a first myth we could talk about, is the idea that when 19 turns to 20, you go from being an adolescent to an adult. And that's just wrong. What we've done is we've been able to look at the studies of the brain, and there's a what's called remodeling of the brain that's beginning sometimes before the teenage years, so an average of around 12, males and females a little different, their timing. But then it goes on not till just 19. It goes on and continues to go on 21, 22, 23, 24, so to the mid-20s. So it's basically adolescence, the period between childhood and adulthood, which you can roughly estimate about the second dozen years of life, way into the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm. About what is happening starting at the age of 12. You talk about pruning of neurons. You're talking about myelin sheath.
Yes.
Give us a broad overview.
Sure. The broad overview is this. You know, in childhood, you're basically soaking in the knowledge of the adult world, and your brain, which is composed of these basic cells called neurons, and they make connections with each other based on both genes and experience. So when you go to school and you have a teacher teaching you something, you soak that in because you're making new, what are called synaptic connections. This is the way you change the structure of the brain, by changing the connections among its basic cells, the neurons. So the first dozen years of life, you can think of it this way. You're growing new neurons based on genes and experience, and you're soaking in the world that the adults have presented you with. And that's a great thing, and it's a wonderful thing to see kids in elementary school just soak in knowledge. But then what surprised everyone was around the time of puberty, puberty's sexual maturation, you know, it's not exactly the same as the changing in the brain, but they roughly go together, but they can be independent in some cases. You start, yes, having hormones rise, but the thing that shocked everyone was instead of the brain just continuing to accumulate new connections, it started to prune them away. It started to get rid of existing synaptic connections. The connections among neurons that had been laid down the first 12 years started to prune them all away. And it even started pruning away actual neurons.
Do we know why that happens?
Well, in nature, there's always a reason, at least long ago, for why something happens. And our belief of why this happens is, basically, childhood is about laying down more connections than you'll ever need. So think about it this way. You're a generalist, so you want to lay down stuff about everything. But for the brain to be efficient, it's got to do what's called integrate. It's got to differentiate areas, which means getting rid of some and strengthening others, and then linking and strengthening the ones that remain. So the purpose overall of pruning, especially when you see it combined with the second process that happens, which is, as you mentioned, myelin. Myelinating neurons means you lay down this very healthy connecting sheath. So if I was a neuron, Ben, and you were another neuron, the way you and I would communicate with each other, believe it or not, would become 3,000 times not only faster, but as we worked in a whole system of other neural connections, it would be more coordinated. Mm-hmm. So the benefit of pruning and myelinating, where you're taking away the excess, leaving what you need, and then myelinating the ones that remain, is you're becoming really more efficient. You're more coordinated. You're more balanced. And as you see these adolescents, really mostly adolescents in the Olympics, they've taken the time to use experience of training. In this case, it's a sport, you know, to do things. And when we look at the Olympics and say, oh, my God, I couldn't do that, we're right. We can do that because our connections aren't 3,000 times as coordinated as theirs, and they can do the flips and the spins and the twizzles and everything they do because they've trained their brain to do it. The same thing is true in adolescence. It's a use-it-or-lose-it principle. And the reason I'm so excited about people getting informed about this is because when you know about your brain, you can actually use your mind to strengthen the connections in your brain. We didn't know that before, and now we know not only in adolescence but across the lifespan. So this period of adolescence, the purpose of it is become more integrated, become more coordinated and balanced by removing what you don't need, keeping what you need, and connecting those areas that you need better.
If you've just joined us, neuropsychiatrist Dr. Daniel Siegel is my guest this hour. Brainstorm is his latest book, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Let's talk about the four qualities you set the foundation in the book of our mind during adolescence, and you use the acronym ESSENCE to capture those.
You know, it's really interesting. When you look at the science of the brain, there are four things that this remodeling brings up, which are really interesting when you see that they each have a purpose, and they each have a downside and an upside. So by learning about these four features, you can actually learn how to reduce the negative parts of what challenge us during adolescence and actually optimize the positive side. So here they are. ES, for the first part of essence, is emotional spark. The brain it processes emotions by the signals from the body, the signals from the lower areas that push upward to alter the way the higher areas of the brain actually allow us to make decisions and think and even perceive things. So there's no question an adolescent brain is more emotional. What's the downside of that? The downside is that you can be irritable, you can be unpredictable, you can be moody, you can have a lot of ups and downs, and that's challenging for anybody. What's the upside? The upside is life is on fire in adolescence. It's full of passion. It's full of oomph. You know, emotions really evoke motion. That's probably where the word comes from. You know, evoking motion. One, it gets you, get you up and out of the house. So there's a great upside to it, but you need to learn to surf these emotions, and that's what I teach in these mindset skill parts of the book, to teach people how to surf their emotions rather than avoid going in the water. You know, the second thing, S-E. Social engagement. The adolescent is driven to push toward their peers and push away from their parents, not totally eliminating their parents in their lives, but to start connecting more with their peers when they're in need. They're getting ready for being out in the world, and this is the purpose of it. What's the downside? Well, the brain knows from evolution that you need to be a member of a group when you leave the home, or you're in grave danger of dying. Of being killed. So membership becomes has a feeling of life and death. This isn't what an adolescent is making up. It's just the nature of our history. So for a parent, when your teen comes to you and says, I have to go to that party, or you've got to buy me this kind of shoe and it's so expensive, and you know, it doesn't mean you have to buy the shoe or let them go to the party, but to begin the dialogue, you need to understand their feeling of desperation is because it is a matter of life and death that they belong to some group. Now, what's the downside of that? The downside is huge. If the group they want to belong to has a bunch of negative behavior, they may give up morality for the benefit of membership. And that kind of peer pressure is a serious problem in lots of different groups. The upside is you learn social skills. You develop the ability to have social networks of support that all the research shows is one of the best things to keep you healthy and strong and happy and living long. So relationships are really important. So that's SE. We have emotional spark, ES, SE, social engagement. What's the N? Novelty. The brain needs to get you ready when you're not a child anymore to prepare to leave the certain, familiar, and comfortable environment of the usually safe home. Now, why would you ever leave something that's comfortable? Why would you ever leave what's certain? So to do that, the brain alters two systems. It alters your reward system, which is governed by a substance called dopamine. It drops the baseline dopamine, raises the release levels, and novelty is what gives you the most release of dopamine. So it makes you bored with the status quo and eager to release dopamine with novelty. What's the downside? The downside of that is you can take risks, especially when you edit this other circuit. The evaluative circuit is going to overemphasize the positive, thrilling part of a choice, de-emphasize a focus on the negative. So you're at risk for dangerous behaviors, for sure. It's not just impulsivity, which is in the early part of teenage years, but it's what's called hyper-rational thinking, focusing on the positive, being driven for the new. And the downside of this is serious. People can have three times the likelihood of serious injury or death during adolescence, even though their bodies are stronger than any other time. And it's because of this change in the brain, not raging hormones, but change in the system. What's the upside? The upside is it lets you have the courage to leave the home nest. And if a parent knows this, if they don't want their child to still be living at home when they're 40 or 50, you've got to honor risk-taking behavior. But you want to educate adolescents so they can decrease the risks. And there are ways of getting in touch with what I call an internal compass so you can combat this hyper-rational, risky behavior that carries on. The final thing, CE, is creative explorations. This is how the mind is thinking in new ways and pushing against the status quo of adults. The reason for that is to really get ready to leave the home and find a whole new world. The benefit for our species is we're incredibly adaptive because of the creative minds of adolescents. As you probably know, the major innovations in art and music and technology and science are primarily from adolescent minds. And that's because of this creative exploration combined with the drive for novelty. And so what you do with creative explorations, what's the downside is you can feel disoriented, you can feel out of sorts, you can feel like you don't belong anywhere, you're doubting everything, and that doesn't feel so good. So it can make adolescents feel lousy. The upside is you're exploring and creating a whole new world, and the world is waiting for us to have some innovation to deal with some of its major problems. So from a species point of view, it's going to be good. From an individual point of view, creativity is an incredibly enriching and rewarding participation to be in, especially when you do it collaboratively with other people.
Dr. Daniel Siegel, my guest, Brainstorm, is his latest book, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned the explosion in science in recent years, the science of the adolescent brain, what we know about it now that we didn't know a generation or two ago. Where have the biggest explosions in knowledge been, in your opinion?
The biggest explosions of knowledge are literally in asking the question, what is really happening during the adolescent period? Before, we just had guesses. All we knew about was what we could see externally with the body changing with puberty. So, of course, people said, oh, puberty, sexual hormones, raging hormones, that's it. That's not the story. When we had the technology advance to be able to look beneath the skull at healthy, developing brains over the lifespan and show that in a given individual, their brain was changing in this way of pruning and myelination, it's called remodeling, and that the ultimate goal of this remodeling is to create a more integrated brain. Integration is where you allow areas to be specialized and take those special areas and link them, and that makes it more coordinated and balanced, as we discussed. So this integrative process is really what adolescence is all about. The second dozen years of life is not about immaturity. It's about transformation. And so that changes our entire attitude toward adolescence. And when you realize integration is the goal of the adolescent remodeling period, you actually can do, and I offer these as the exercise in the book, you can do exercises to increase integration in the brain. And this is really completely new stuff. No one was talking like this 15 years ago. We didn't know this information. And in fact, even the idea that you could use your mind to change the structure of your brain, though some of us were saying it before, we didn't have the definitive data. Now we have the definitive scientific studies that tell us, without a doubt, how you focus your mind in exercises you can do can actually improve the structure of the brain, and in particular, it increases the integrative capacity of the brain, so it makes the brain function more in harmony. Mm-hmm. And these are fantastic times to empower people with this knowledge.
Now you have many of these exercises in your book, but can you give us a short, perhaps simple example of what you just described?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, any of these you can do through my website. So if you go to drdansiegel.com, and for free, you can just download they're called MindSight resources, and you can just do them in your own time. But here, just to say briefly, if you think about how we usually focus our attention, we're on screens, we're looking outside at the cars passing by if we're driving a car. We're very busy externally focused. So the first thing to say is that when you focus your mind on the internal nature of your own experience or on the internal nature of someone else's experience, so for your own, it's called insight. For another person, it's called empathy. Research is very clear. When you do practices that I'll mention in a moment that develop insight and empathy, it builds the integrative regions of the brain. These are regions of the brain that link widely separate areas to each other. And when you develop this integration, you improve your ability to focus attention. You improve your ability to balance your emotions. You improve your ability to think clearly under stress. You even improve your ability to be empathic for others. So what's really cool about this is not only do we see these improvements, but we can look in the brain and see that the parts of the brain responsible for those improvements has actually changed its structure from these practices. So that's just the background. Now, what is the practice? Here's a simple practice that builds your own attentional capacity to get ready for the second practice. And I'll just say the second practice as a name, but it's more extensive, but it's called the Wheel of Awareness practice. And it basically integrates awareness in this kind of really accessible way. But to build yourself, you can do this for, you know, a week or two to get ready to start the Wheel of Awareness practice. But the basic practice that we've studied here at UCLA that's been studied all around the world that's really powerful is unbelievably simple. It costs nothing, and here's what it is. You get yourself seated somewhere where you're very comfortable, where let's say you can have 5 minutes of uninterrupted time. Turn off any kind of phones or anything that would disturb you. Be in a quiet space, and when you get trained in this, you can don't even need a quiet space. You can do it anywhere. But for the beginning, you have quiet space. And then let yourself get settled with your back straight, and then let the breath become the focus of your attention. And what that means is let the sensation of the breath fill your awareness. So you wouldn't want to do this when you're driving because you're going to start focusing inwardly. So if someone's listening to this show when they're driving, please do not practice it. You want to be without driving a vehicle. But in general, you focus on the breath and the sensation of the breath, whether it's at the nostrils or the air coming in and out, the chest rising and falling, or the abdomen going up and down. These become the bodily sensations that just fill awareness. Now, the exercise is this. Keep your focus of attention on the sensation of the breath. And if you're like most people, at some point, a distraction will pull you away from the sensation of the breath. You'll start thinking about dinner. You'll start thinking about what you did last week. You'll start thinking about the plans you have for a month from now. Some thought, some memory, some image, some feeling, something will distract you. And that's fine. It's like releasing a muscle when you're exercising. But to tighten the muscle, you refocus on the breath.
Now, this sounds like...
And then you get distracted again, and bam. And that's how you basically tighten the muscle of attention. And we did a study to show if you just learn this, you'll strengthen attention really, really well. And we have a lot of studies now that prove that this kind of simple exercise actually builds the strength of the mind's ability to focus attention, actually changes the structure of the brain in good ways.
What you just described is a simple exercise in meditation.
You know, the word meditation sometimes gets people upset, and the word meditation really means training the mind. So, yes, it's a form of training the mind, and you can use the word meditation. For some people, they think meditation means it's some form of religion or other.
I see.
But it's not. It's actually a brain-training mind exercise, and that's what the word meditation really means. So, yes, it's a form of training the mind, absolutely.
Okay. We're going to take a short break and then come back with our guest this hour, neuropsychiatrist Dr. Daniel Siegel. His book is titled Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. And when we come back, we'll talk more about it. And in particular, we'll talk about how adolescence can be more of a golden age, both for the teen and for the parent, not this tussle, this back and forth struggle. We all know about it, whether we were on the teen end or the parenting end of it, or we've experienced both ends of it. We'll find out how that might be different, and we'll also find out how we can, as adults, enrich our lives with these ideas, bust out of perhaps a life that's become too routine, make our lives more vital by learning from what science is learning from the teenage brain. Dr. Daniel Siegel, our guest, will be right back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. My guest this hour, Dr. Daniel Siegel, he's a clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine. His new book is titled Brainstorm, The Power and the Purpose of the Teenage Brain, sort of putting the teenage years or our myths about the teenage years, standing them on their head to try to benefit both teens in their development and parents, adults, in learning from teens and bringing the teens through this critical phase of life. When we left off, Dr. Siegel, I was talking about how most of us conceive of the teenage parent relationship. Often a lot of tension there, a period that can often feel like one is at war with the other. What do you feel is at the heart of that tension?
Oh, gosh. You know, Ben, it's a great question. I think there's lots of different things going on. One thing I think is that parents feel really concerned about the well-being of their adolescent, and risky behaviors can be pretty terrifying. And the adults are not overreacting in the sense that there's a 3 times higher likelihood of adolescents being seriously injured or even killed than during childhood. So, you know, this is a serious time of risk-taking behaviors, and why I so much want adolescents to learn to empower themselves, to understand what's going on in their brains, is I think they can minimize these risky behaviors that adults sometimes can't even influence them. So it's a real concern. I think that's one of the things that just gets us, you know, very worried as parents. The second thing I think is that there's a kind of pushback from adolescents as the brain is getting itself ready to take this child and put them out in the world as an adult. There's a transformation that requires a pushback on adults. And I think when adults take it personally and they say, oh, I have to educate my adolescent about how to behave respectfully, and they start fighting with their adolescent, they're not really realizing that there's going to be a natural pushing back. And if you give that like about a 90-second space of time to let it just float over you and not take it so personally, you can continue engaging with an adolescent, usually in a pretty positive way. But adults, parents, who dive in and start fighting with them because they said something that was a little irritable or irritated or maybe a little disrespectful because they think they need to teach them a lesson, this creates a huge, huge unnecessary conflict. So I think that pushback, which is a natural part of adolescence, and some do it to very small, subtle degrees, some do it in large degrees, and each of us as a parent needs to figure out how we're going to handle it. But I think understanding that it's a natural change in the brain to push back on the adult world, and there's no better place to start that than at home. You know, when you realize that, it gives you a whole different way of experiencing being a parent. A third thing, and this came up in writing the book, that parents have now affirmed, now that they've read the book, because, you know, they're reading it now, and it's a hard thing to talk about, and since the book is also for adults, I wanted to say it in a really clear way. There's an essence that we talked about of adolescence, the emotional spark, this passion adolescents have, the social engagement, the friends they connect with, the novelty, they're diving into new things, their creative explorations, they're challenging their minds in new ways. This essence, for a lot of people I know, either professionally as patients or in my personal life, they've kind of lost that essence. So life has become kind of dull. It's not full of a spark. They kind of become isolated because they're so busy at work, so they don't have the social engagement. Mm-hmm. They kind of do the same old all the time, so there's not much novelty, and they're not challenging their minds.
This ties in back to the tension that we were talking about earlier. You write in your book that often when a parent cannot stand some aspect of their teen, that it's reminding them, that they may not realize it, of something that bugs them about their own life.
You know, when I ask adolescents or adults, you know, that I'm teaching these days about the book, and I say, what do you think that feels like? And people say, well, I guess I'm jealous. I guess I'm really upset because it's reminding me of something I really wish I still had. But I say, I got to grow up. So I say to my teen, just grow up, instead of, wow, you've got something. I used to have too, because I used to be a teenager. I used to be an adolescent. Let me figure out how to get it back. And the beautiful thing is, you as an adult not only can get this back, the essence, but you ought to, because every study of your brain as an adult says these are the top 4 things to keep in your life throughout your lifespan: passion for what you do, emotional spark, social engagement, good social support systems, novelty, try doing things in new ways, creative explorations, challenge your mind. You know, these are actually the top 4 in the study of what's called neuroplasticity, how we as adults keep on keeping our brains young and vital. So, you know, that might be something that could really transform a parent's relationship with an adolescent if they get in touch inside of them, like, wow, I think there's something here that's really bugging me about me, that I'm missing this stuff. And that's a beautiful thing, because it's always possible to course correct, take a deep breath, say, wow, I guess I was feeling this, so I was acting this way, but I could, you know, change the way I am and improve my relationship with myself and my adolescent.
Looking back at your own child rearing, you said you have two children now, I believe you said, in their 20s. Did you make some mistakes that you look back on now and say, oh, I wish I had known that better?
You know, there are absolutely mistakes, not only that I made before, that I think if I had had this book, I wouldn't have made, but I still make them, you know, because we're human, and I actually put these mistakes in the Brainstorm book, and I've mentioned them in, for example, Parenting from the Inside Out. So the good news is, if we can know the direction we want to take and we make mistakes, we can actually repair those ruptures that happen because of the mistakes. So the reason I put myself in my books like that is, and show all the mistakes that I've done and my efforts to try to correct them as best I could, when my kids read it, you know, they say, why did you put yourself in the book like that? I said, well, was it accurate? They go, yeah, that's exactly what happened. They go, but you look like a jerk. And I say, you know, well, I wanted to show people that you can actually be thinking about this stuff and writing about this stuff, and you still do things. And the importance isn't that you're a perfect parent, because there's no such thing as perfect parents. The issue is, can you recognize when things don't go the way they ought to and course correct with making a repair?
Dr. Daniel Siegel, my guest. Brainstorm is his latest book, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. Let's go back to a point you mentioned earlier, the four qualities of our minds during adolescence. We talked about social engagement, and when we talk about, well, you talked about the explosion in knowledge of brain science, but let's talk about the explosion in technology that we've had as it concerns social engagement. We parents know that it's pretty hard to talk with a teen these days who is not texting or otherwise somehow engaged with technology. How do we know how the digital age is engaging the teen brain, considering that one of the key elements of the teen brain is to get that social engagement? Any thoughts on that?
It's such an important question you're raising and such an important issue. The wisdom there is, as a parent, to know that the key thing is human relationships. So in our home, for example, we have a rule, no smartphones at the table during dinner. Dinner is a time to communicate with each other, any meal, you know, to really have face-to-face time to talk to each other. And that we want to recognize that the kinds of communication that happen over the, you know, chatting or texting or, you know, email or anything like that is so much thinner than face-to-face communication, that we talk to our adolescents about this so they understand how important it is to make sure you have face-to-face time. So one general rule about technology is, it isn't so much the negative things that technology are doing, although it does offer some very negative things like bullying, cyberbullying, and things like that. But in general, what the big negative is what it's keeping people from doing, which is often keeping people, not just adolescents, but adults too, from literally taking in eye contact, facial expressions, the tone of a voice, gestures, posture, the timing, the intensity of the things you say. These nonverbal signals are the window into a person's soul. They're the way you really get to feel the inner life of another person. You know, I call this mindsight, you know, seeing the mind or soul, the inner essence of a person. And sadly, I think what's happening, in Sherry Turkle, in her wonderful book, Alone Together, beautifully reviews the background on this, that we're interconnected digitally, but we feel so alone. And I think it's because of this reason, that the true inner life that we could be connecting to is really not communicated through these channels of digital communication.
Let's talk about another phenomenon that we've seen in recent years. You deal in this book also in the teenage brain. Of course, that's the time of puberty, sexual maturation. What is your view of the current widespread practice of hooking up among young people, engaging in some sort of casual sex with someone you do not have a serious relationship with. Is this new in adolescent history?
You know, I think it is new in our culture, not new like in the last 6 months, but new in the last maybe, 10 years or more, where there is a change in how kids are connecting with each other sexually in very, very, very casual ways. It seems very ironic in a day and age of lethal sexually transmitted diseases that as that's rising, you also have this rising. So it's kind of perplexing in terms of the safety of it. But from a relational point of view, it's really, and I talk a lot about this in the sections on hooking up in the book, this issue that we're having people engage physically in a sexual way without the emotional closeness, without the emotional trust, without the long-term getting to know someone, is making sexual activity very superficial. So in some ways, it's actually a parallel to what we talked about technology, that there's kind of a surface level of connecting that when you really talk to people about hooking up, it's not very satisfying. It can be sexually gratifying, but not emotionally satisfying. And for adolescents to know this, I think is really, really important. And so in one of the examples I give in the book, I talk about this therapeutic relationship I had with someone who was busy hooking up and, what it means to have a close emotional connection versus what it means to just be casually, sexually involved with someone. Very, very different. And what I deeply hope can happen is that people can really see the interconnected nature of, your sexual life and your emotional life when they're hand in hand. It's a beautiful, unbelievably rewarding thing. And when they become separated, it can become very thin and not so rewarding. So all these things are part of, you're asking, why is this happening? Is it new? I think they're part of a very superficial way we've learned to exist that is not very rewarding. And I think it's supporting the reason the research is showing that adolescents and young adults are extremely stressed and feeling very dissatisfied with these practices that are there. And I hope that thinking more deeply about it can make them wake up and realize, wow, I don't have to live my life like that. I can get a deeper connection to myself, to others, and to even the whole world.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting in your book, in that context, the context in which we talk about hooking up and other aspects of 21st century adolescence, that adolescence, we have to remind ourselves, as you do us in the book, is it didn't exist until recently, this period of extended adolescence.
Ben, that's absolutely right. When you look at the research data from 100, 150 years ago, puberty, which is the external sign that something is changing, it's not exactly the onset of adolescence, but it's the best we can do as a marker, used to start around 15, 16 years of age for a girl and a little bit older for a boy. And then the time of going from that sexual maturation to assuming adult responsibilities of starting a family or starting work was about 2 or 3 years later for a female and about 3 or 4 years later for a male. So, that period of adolescence, the period between childhood dependency and adult responsibility, is about 2 to 4 years, depending on male or female. Now, this is huge because now adolescence starts not that mid-teenage years, but it's starting before the teenage years for many girls, at least the beginning of sexual maturation, and for boys about a year and a half later. And at last, this period of adolescence is lasting the mid-20s. So you got a dozen years at least of this period of adolescence when before it was just a couple years. So that's a big, big change that we've never seen before. And I think it's very important for us understanding the real science of adolescence and making the most of this now extended period of time.
What are some of the ways, we haven't talked about this yet, that we know brain science has told us that the male brain is different from the female brain in adolescence?
Well, the timing of this remodeling is a bit different. So the pruning and myelination occur a little bit about a year and a half sooner for females and a year and a half later, of course, for boys, for males. And what's interesting is the researchers conclude that this remodeling, while the timing is off a little bit in terms of when it happens, ends up basically in exactly the same place. So the remodeling doesn't have a clear male-female difference that really makes a big difference. So, you know, this is they all end up the same place. However, there's a difference in the way males are influenced by testosterone, the male hormone, and females are influenced by progesterone and estrogen, the female hormones. And, you know, the androgens, these other hormones that are in both males and females, can influence sexual drive in different ways in different individuals. Here's the key thing about the brain in particular, not so much the hormones, but the brain. If you were a researcher, Ben, and I said, okay, here's a brain scan, whether it's just structural, where you're looking at the connections in the brain, or functional, you know, you're looking at how the brain is functioning. And I said to you, hey, Ben, is this a male or a female brain? And you've got the whole scan. You're looking under the skull. You're looking at the brain itself. There is no way you could tell me if it's a male or female brain. So what I say to people is, look, you know, there's so much more in common between the male and female brain than is different. And the differences are so varied that to make a generalization is really a very precarious thing to do. And what I mean by precarious is if you're a female with some male, in quotes, traits, you may think there's something wrong with you, and there's nothing wrong with you. And if you're a male with some more what are called female traits, there's nothing wrong with you. So it's really a big risk to start making generalizations which are not held up by the science, I've got to say. When you really look at the science, like I'm saying, you can't put a scan in front of a researcher or a clinician and say, male or female, they can't tell you.
Will we be able to see that in the future, though?
We don't think so. You know, and the reason is that the differences are so varied. I mean, it's sort of like height, if you think about it this way. If you put a person in front of you who's 5'8", are they male or female?
You can't tell. You can make a generalization, but you might be very wrong, right?
You might be very wrong. And why should a female who's 5'8" say, well, most females are 5'4" or 5'3"? You know, there's something wrong with them. No, there's nothing wrong with you. You're just 5'8". It's the same thing with, you know, a male who might be short, you know, shorter than the average male. So this is why I think we need to be super careful about some of these things that are out in the public domain that are saying male brain, female brain. I know, you know, some of those writings, and I know the science. And, you know, when you're really careful about the science, you would say it just like I just said it. And for adolescents, of course, you say, well, don't boys take bigger risks? Yes. You know, there's more physicality, there's more jumping off of cliffs that I talk about in the book. There's no question there's differences in males and females. Absolutely. But when you're talking about specifically about brain structures, there's patterns, but there aren't specifics that are just so clear that you would be able to see them on a scan.
How can we as adults learn from what we know about teenage brain science to make ourselves, our lives, less of a routine, more vital?
Well, I think the way you make your life more vital as an adult is you dive into some of these mindset exercises that literally can liberate the emotional spark in you, can help you develop more friendships that are deeper and more supportive in your life, the social engagement, can really give you the courage to say, wow, I'm really tired at the end of the day. I keep on doing things in the same way. But even if you do things subtly, like, you know, if you have a dog, walk your dog around a different block. You know, try thinking about things in new ways for creative exploration. So you can actually, and I have all these exercises there. These exercises, while the adolescent reading the book can do them, they're just as suitable for adults to do. And the fantastic thing is that if you take on this essence in your own life and really say, wow, the brain keeps on changing throughout the lifespan, I can actually do something intentionally to capture this essence in my life, and that's actually be the best thing I could do to keep my brain strong, keep it integrated, keep it growing well. Even just that attitude, and now that you have the steps, that's the first step to take in the pathway to make your life more enriched. And it's great to see that adolescents can benefit and adults can benefit, their relationships can benefit. So it's a win-win situation all around.
It reminds me, what you're saying is a very common occurrence. Well, in more than one person who's, well, 60s, 70s, even older into the 80s or 90s that I've talked to, seemingly very happy people. And this always makes me curious. And a comment you'll often hear is, that they're surprised when they look in the mirror and see an old person because inside they feel like a teenager. It's exactly what you're saying.
Ben, that is exactly it. You hit it on the nail. That, you know, think about it. And studies show, you know, and I could quote you all the studies, but basically I'll just say this. Studies show exactly that. You bring this attitude of an identity, of capturing this essence, and not only are you going to feel better, but the studies are very clear. You will actually keep your body younger. It doesn't mean you're going to live forever. It doesn't mean you prevent all diseases or anything like that. But you will keep your body younger. You're going to live with more vitality. It is research proven, not just opinion, that you can do this. And the great news is you are now empowered to have the steps on how to do it.
Thank you for spending the hour with us, Dr. Daniel Siegel. Brainstorm, Dr. Siegel's latest book, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. We appreciate your time and all the tips to make us feel and think younger.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. Our program is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River, available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.